The second case this morning, United States v. PPG Industries. You can take your time, Mr. Yockish. We don't have any briefs spilled all over the floor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Steve Yockish, and I represent the plaintiff appellants in this case, the United Steelworkers and its local 193G. This dispute concerns an arbitrator's decision regarding the issues that were proper for bargaining when the steelworkers and PPG were bargaining a successor contract in June of 2009. And more particularly, it considers a dispute over some language in the collective bargaining agreement that essentially provided that the party seeking to reopen the agreement had to present its proposals at the first day of negotiations. In this case, the employer was seeking substantial non-economic and economic concessions in the collective bargaining agreement. And it presented on the first day of negotiations non-economic proposals. And then on day two and day three of negotiations, it presented its economic proposals. And the union took the position that the proposals that were presented on day two and day three of negotiations were invalid because they conflicted with the express language of the relevant provision of the contract.
Now, let me just, because time is so short,
yes,
I'd like to ask you things that you know I'm thinking about.
Please.
The company says, and the district court found, that the company's opening statement on June 1st mentioned the need for wage concessions from current employees. Why would that not be adequate notice of the proposal? I mean, I know that the court was citing PPG's notes for its opening statement, but are you, what I'm trying to figure out, what I've been trying to figure out, is are you arguing that PPG did not really say this in the opening statement, or are you arguing only that the arbitrator did not rely on it?
I'm arguing that the arbitrator did not rely on it. The quote cited in the district court opinion is taken from notes that the lead negotiator brought with him to the arbitration hearing. There was no transcript of the arbitration hearing per se. And the arbitrator did not make that specific fact-finding. Even if the arbitrator had made a fact-finding in that on that specific point, I would say that the specificity of that statement did not rise to what you would call a proposal. And I would say that really that boils down to the company's desire, which was the desire to maintain top-tier wages at one point and second-tier wages at another point, as opposed to a specific proposal with respect to where each tier ought to be. And I think if the arbitrator had meant that the company's foreshadowing of two tiers and $10 an hour difference was enough to put the union on notice, he would not have held that the proposals, when presented in their precise form 2 days later, were invalid. And so the way that we have always seen the arbitrator's award in this case is that the mere statement that the company alleges that they made on the first day was not deemed by the arbitrator to be a proposal and therefore did not count for the purposes of what you have to say on the first day of negotiations.
Now, of course, the simplest way to find out what the arbitrator meant would be to ask the arbitrator.
I don't think there's any dispute under this court's cases, particularly a case that the court decided a couple of years ago called the, I believe the name of the case is Teamsters. No, that's not the name of the case. It's I know that it's in 500 F 3rd, and it's a decision by Judge Posner. The court has the power, and it can certainly, even without the request of the party, send it back to the arbitrator. And, you know, I think one thing that Judge Posner noted in that decision was that often the parties go for broke. I would be trying to fool the court if I didn't say that we were going for broke.
Yeah.
Here. I will say that it's our position that if you look at the entire record of the arbitrators of the arbitration, which is what I think is appropriate here, that that entire record indicates that the arbitrator did not mean to hold that the wages and benefits of current employees of the company were valid proposals, because those were the proposals made on June 2nd and June 3rd. But I concede that if the court comes to the conclusion that the only way to really know is to send it back to the arbitrator and ask him, that the court has the authority to do so.
Well, now, the company says that it withdrew from its final offer proposals that had been raised for the first time on June 2nd and June 3rd. I mean, would you agree that some items were withdrawn?
I would agree that some items were withdrawn.
So how then can you argue that the district court and the company gave no meaning to the arbitrator's award?
The items that the company withdrew were, although they could be characterized as economic, they were items of very little economic value. I think we can assert that the district court gave no meaning to the arbitrator's award, because it's our view that when the arbitrator said that the proposals that were made on June 2nd and June 3rd were invalid, he meant all of the proposals, not just the five or six that the company withdrew, but the proposals with respect to cutting the wages and benefits of current employees and with respect to cutting the benefits that the employees in the second tier enjoyed. And, I mean, I think it's kind of ironic, because it bespeaks the company's ambiguity about the award, that they, too, said, well, we've got to withdraw some things in order to comply with it. They didn't withdraw the most important things, which were proposals that were made on the second 2 days of that first week of negotiations. And so, you know, it's really our view that the arbitrator saw the dispute very clearly, and that the arbitrator recognized that the company had raised some things before the first day. We had argued against that, but we lost that point in the arbitration.
But if he if he did so, why are you going for broke? Why are you here?
So let me answer that at two levels, Your Honor. I mean, one reason why we're here is that this is an extraordinarily fractious labor dispute. Employees, $37 an hour, that's an all-in cost. You look at the wages, they're very modest under this contract. You're making between $35,000 and $40,000 a year if there's not a lot of overtime. Company wants to reduce that by a third. And even in Zion, Illinois, that's not much to live on, all right? So that's a motivation. And I think in footnote 2 of the district court's decision, the district court notes that there was a period of time where the parties actually tried to resolve this dispute. So we're here because we think that if you read the record that was created before the arbitrator, and you read the arbitrator's decision, that it was clear that he meant to exclude the proposals that were made on June 2nd and June 3rd with respect to current employees from bargaining.
Wouldn't it be an odd result, though, for the arbitrator to consider the $10 reduction in the two-tiered system as being set forth on the first day, coupled with, and you agree that the previous statements, the Chicago meeting and the, I think it was a May 28th email, all are included in the notice given to the union.
That's what the arbitrator held, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But if the arbitrator found that the $10 reduction of the two-tiered system were on the table, wouldn't it be an odd result where you couldn't consider proposals that would make that feasible?
So let me take that in two pieces. First, the normal use of a two-tiered system is you keep the current people where they are and you reduce the new people coming in. So it would not be an odd result if the only thing at issue here was a two-tiered system to have a holding that says, yeah, where they don't make a proposal to cut the wages of the top tier until 2 or 3 days later, that's excluded. Now, on the $10, it would be a very odd result if the only way to get to the $10 was to cut the wages of current employees. Now, while the company believed that it would be hard to get to the $10 without cutting current employees, if you look at the math, it's not mathematically impossible. In their email on May 28th, for example, they propose a wage rate of $11.50 for employees in the second tier. Well, that's several dollars above the minimum wage. Also, there's an ambiguity about what wage rate applies to recalled employees, whether they're new employees in the bottom tier or old employees in the top tier. And finally, the parties were discussing a buyout for employees in the top tier. And, of course, if you have a sufficiently compelling buyout for the employees in the top tier, then you've switched the numbers of the people in the top tier versus the people in the bottom tier. And if you look at the email of that the company sent to Mr. Mazzeau on May 28th, it was assuming the current populations of employees in those tiers, not the populations that you might have if you had a buyout. So while I agree that it would be hard to get to the $10, I don't agree that it would be impossible, and I don't agree that the company's failure to spell out the way that it wanted to get to the $10 was therefore proper after the first day of negotiations.
Has there ever been a dispute like this before between this union and employer, or this union and anyone, where they've said that you've never put it on the table the first day?
If you look at the arbitrator's decision, what happened was this language was negotiated in like 1959, and the parties had lived with the language for 50 years, and this language had never come into dispute. Both sides looked, neither side found anything. And so the answer is no, this contract language had never been the subject of, as far as any side can tell, a grievance or an arbitrator's decision before. So I think I've hit the high points, and I think unless the panel has any further questions, I would like to save whatever time I have left to rebuttal.
That'd be fine. Thank you. Mr. Joyce.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I think that the question of what could have been put in place in light of the proposals that had been made really needs to start with the union's own reply brief. And they sort of tee this up very nicely when they say on pages 8 and 9, because the arbitrator specifically approved a two-tier system, union has conceded that PPG's proposed wage reductions for employees in the second tier were timely, even though PPG-specific proposals for those second-tier wage reductions were not made until after June 1, 2008. So that same reasoning, a timely economic proposal followed by details, applies to PPG's other timely cost reduction proposals.
Did the union receive the May 28th email in a readable format before the June 1st conference began? I mean, the union claims it did not. And so those proposals were not raised in a timely fashion. The union says it was garbled. Where in the record can the three of us find an answer to what exactly the union saw before the June 1st conference.
Yes, Your Honor. So the March 28th email, well, first off.
May, excuse me.
The May 28th email is in the record at docket 22-4 at page 47. And I think what the union was suggesting is that a version of this, that the grid was not readable, so it was resent. But equally important to the question of notice is what the text of the email said. And they don't suggest that they didn't get the text of the email, just that the chart was somehow unreadable. But the text of the email sort of explains what the calculation was, and then says that we have a blended $3.21 bogey over and above what the bottom tier what we get with the bottom tier fully populated. And he goes on to say, I really think it would be difficult to get to the $27 reduction without significant concessions from current employees.
But if the grid is garbled, then the union is left having to take your word in the text for what is actually there without the possibility of figuring it out for itself.
Well, if that were the only, if the garbled chart were the only notice, I suppose that may be an argument worth considering. But as
no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the text was your interpretation of what this grid says. And in other words, they have to take it on faith because it's unreadable. The grid itself is unreadable. Am I wrong?
If the grid was garbled, they would not be able to actually verify the statement. That's correct, Your Honor. But again, I think the question of the arbitrator's award is what notice they were given on multiple instances before June 1 or as of June 1. So the arbitrator says that the proposals in this case need not be of any particular specificity, and they don't need to be in writing. And so the evidence that he then recites in the award is that on May 14th, we tell them, the company tells them that we need a labor cost reduction of $10 and a two-tiered wage system. They discuss the form of a two-tier wage system in an earlier proposal, and the company says that's not going to be enough in these negotiations to obtain this goal. Subsequently, there is this May 28th email that the union asks be sent to them, which contains the statement I referenced. And then the arbitrator notes that Mr. Mordawanek on June 1st, when the negotiations started, also indicated in his opening remarks that they needed a two-tier structure. And if you look at the record evidence, Mr. Mordawanek's opening remarks are in the record as well at 22-4 at page 48, and he specifically says, and the district court quoted this, we will propose a new wage and benefit structure for new hires. This wage and benefit structure is designed to get our labor costs in line with our primary competitors. We will need to make adjustments to wages and benefits for current employees. So the body of evidence that's in the record shows that the union was on notice as to what the company's proposed proposals were in a timely fashion, both with respect to the wage reduction, admittedly not in the same level of details if, in fact, they were unable to discern the garbled chart. But the award specifically says all we need to do is advise them without any particular level of specificity what the proposals were before the opening day of conference. And both the district court and the arbitrator found that in fact, those proposals had been timely made. And so according to the union's own concession in their reply brief, as long as they were advised as to the particular proposals before June 1, the fact that there were additional details that had to be filled in didn't render what the company did in any way improper.
How do you respond to the union's argument that if a violation of Section 2 of the agreement had consequences only until the expiration of the agreement, it would be meaningless? In other words, are you contending that this provision does not survive the expiration of the agreement?
We do not believe that this provision, the Section 2, survives the expiration of the contract. Metropolitan Edison Supreme Court case specifically says that that demonstrating that a provision is designed to survive the expiration of a labor contract has to be clear and unmistakable in the document. And there's no indication that there was an intent to have this provision extend beyond the expiration of the contract. So under Metropolitan Edison, we would hold that there's nothing in that provision that says it's designed to extend beyond that. Now, the union says, well, that's crazy, or that's no one could have ever intended that. Well, this provision had been around for 50 years. Apparently, no one had given it much thought. But the point is that to the extent that there's contractual language, that's what we're supposed to look at in deciding whether or not there's a post-expiration survival of a contract provision. That's what Metropolitan Edison held a long time ago. And so whether that provision could be gamed, whether there is a loophole there, is just a function of how the contract was drafted, inartfully or otherwise. So the idea that it may have a limited duration is not itself a reason to give it greater life, even though it fails to meet the test that the Supreme Court laid out in Metropolitan Edison. And Your Honor asked another question about remand to the arbitrator, and I would just point out that in this case, the district court, in accordance with this court's decision in BMM Transit, properly looked to the underlying record to see whether or not there was, in fact, any ambiguity as to what the company had put the union on notice on. So I don't think this is a case where there's a necessity to go back to the arbitrator and ask. I think the underlying record, which is properly considered along with the award itself, demonstrates that PPG gave an adequate explanation as to what it intended to accomplish in these negotiations, both with respect to wage reductions for current employees, wage reductions for employees on the second tier.
Can you distinguish between what they intended to accomplish versus what they what they actually proposed? Because it's a fuzzy proposal if you take all this together. This is what we want to accomplish. Compared to what I think the union is suggesting is, what happened on the second and third day, you had concrete examples of how you were going to accomplish the wage reduction and the two-tier system.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think what the arbitrator said is, well, what you properly articulated at some level, admittedly not in the level of specificity as of June 2nd, was a $10 reduction in labor costs and a two-tier wage system. Those are the two items that had been identified. And then, as I pointed out, in explaining those two concepts up until June 1st, they explained that they would accomplish that through reductions both as to current employees and employees who would be placed on the second tier. So the arbitrator, prior to making those rulings, initially said the union wants, and Mr. Jokic alluded to this during his argument, that it had to be more specific in order for it to satisfy the Section 2 requirement, and the arbitrator specifically rejected that. And he said, I can't add to this arbitration award something that the parties didn't put there themselves. He said that the proposals don't have to be in writing, and they don't have to have any particular level of specificity. And while it might be more preferable for there to be more specificity, the contract doesn't require it. And so I think this question of sort of the level of specificity argues for a standard that the arbitrator himself rejected. And so the union seems to concede that in their reply brief, where they say, we concede that this one thing was properly articulated to us before June 1st, and they could fill in the details later. Well, the record evidence shows that all of these concepts, reductions for both current employees and for employees on the second tier, were all teed up to the union no later than June 1st. And the arbitrator made that rule finding, and then the district court looked at the arbitrator's award in total, not viewing it in isolation and the underlying record, and came to the same conclusion. And so to the extent that there is a requirement that there be some level of information provided to the union, we contend that we complied with what the arbitrator found was required no later than June 1st. And if there's not any other further questions, I would ask that the lower court's decision be affirmed.
Well, thank you very much, counsel.
So I think it's important to take a look at what actually the arbitrator said. The arbitrator said that the proposals that were made on June 2nd and June 3rd were untimely. And that's because he interpreted the clear language of the contract. But he also went on to say, well, I'll make an exception to that for the goal of a target of 10 and the goal of a two-tier. The union had notice of those. But he didn't go on to then say that his exception would swallow up the entire rest of his decision. And that's what the company wants you to do, is they want you to hold that because he wrote those two narrow exceptions into his general holding, that they should then swallow up everything that happened afterwards. And I think it's important in this case to know that it's very clear that in terms of the foreshadowing of those two things, there were exactly two things that were that happened. One was the meeting at O'Hare Airport, and the other was the email that Judge Rovner referred to. And that email is in the record in the company's motion for summary judgment with the rest of the union exhibits. And those were the only two things that happened. There was no discussion of things like health insurance, vacation benefits, or a list of other changes that the company put into effect after proposed and put into effect, proposed after June 1st and put into effect when they made their eventual unilateral implementation. Now, well, the arbitrator found that the company had been specific enough with respect to its goal of its $10 target, and that it had been specific enough with respect to its goal of a two-tier system. It did not find anything else was specific enough to get around the clear language of the contract. Specifically, the arbitrator did not find that Mr. Mornowanek was specific about wages on the first day of negotiation, and he did not find that he was specific about wages with respect to current employees on the first day of negotiations. And those are fact findings and legal holdings of the arbitrator under the contract that the court has to respect. And that's why we think that the district judge erred, and that's why we think that this case should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.